Everyone is entitled to his own opinion, but not to his own facts. These words belong to Daniel Patrick Moynihan, and I thought that they were quite fitting to start my short recording with, in which I want to take you by the hand and walk you through my chapter contribution, which discusses the topic of fake news. Of course, fake news was not a foreign concept to me when I started looking for a topic for my thesis in late 2019. I think especially after the 2016 US presidential elections and the UK vote to leave the EU, which were both heavily dominated by claims of fake news, the problem and accompanying discussions should have been on everyone's radar. By now we know that online fake news outperform real news because lies spread significantly faster, farther, deeper and more broadly through social networks than the truth, and that it takes true stories about 6 times as long as false stories to reach people. And this is particularly worrying given that recent studies found that 47% of adults are getting their news from social media. However, for me, the most memorable, and in a frightening way, contribution on the topic was a speech by Sacha Baron Cohen that I highly recommend reading or listening to, in which he pointed out some of the real dangers of fake news online, which go far beyond the democratic threats of manipulating our beliefs and thus risking the freedom of our electoral processes that is often talked about in this context. He remarked that democracy, which depends on shared truth, is in retreat, and autocracy, which depends on shared lies, is on the march. And going back in history, Voltaire already warned us that when he said, "Those who can make you believe absurdities can make you commit atrocities." And social media platforms now enable authoritarians to reach billions of people with their absurdities. By the time I started writing in May 2020, the COVID-19 pandemic had come to Europe, and my topic had become more relevant than ever, I would say. Fake news numbers were exploding and the harmful potential of such content became all the more evident. I think we have all heard and read stories how taking vitamin C would prevent infection, or even worse, how drinking bleach or taking certain malaria drugs would provide a cure, not to speak of all the later fake news regarding infection and death numbers and also vaccination campaigns. And although, of course, I realize that fake news manifest themselves not only as direct actions of persons writing false content, but also as, I like to call it, a general underlying breeding ground of various factors of psychological, philosophical, technological, and economic nature, as a law graduate, the question for me was how to tackle this problem from a legal point of view. What can the law do, realistically, to help with this infodemic that we are currently experiencing? There's a large part of the academic community which operates under the marketplace of ideas theory, and they argue that we should not try to regulate or restrict such dangerous speech, but that the proper strategy would simply be more speech. So we should flood people with actual news so that they eventually, when they're presented with both, they are able to sort out truth from falsehood by themselves. However, I think if we keep in line with this metaphor, we also have to recognize that sometimes markets simply fail. And indeed, with all the research and reporting requirements and the need for editors and fact-checkers, true news stories take longer and they are much more expensive to create. And in contrast, the creative process behind fake news takes only one person with a little bit of imagination and a working computer to create content within minutes. And psychological factors such as our cognitive bias when we process information, our tendency to be more open to stories that engage our emotions, and often simply our unwillingness or lack of time to extensively research both sides of story further undermine this theory. And as a reaction to this failure, and in view of very important national elections which are taking place in 2021 and 2022 in Europe, we have seen a uniquely strong regulatory urge towards fake news. Countries such as Germany, France, Hungary, and Russia introduced laws to tackle online disinformation, and the European Commission has put forward its EU-wide code of conduct for online platforms. And to the best of my knowledge, there is no other centralized efforts to set out rules for the identification and the removal of fake news. But when it comes to legal intervention towards restriction of fake news, the primary concern is, of course, that we can never forget to sufficiently consider the fundamental right to free expression that is at stake. And in my chapter of this Anthem Press volume, I am examining to what extent fake news can actually be regulated while preserving the fundamental right to freedom of expression in Europe. Before I delve into an overview of my analysis, a brief terminology check is important, I believe. Although you presumably have an understanding of what is meant when one speaks of fake news and fake news laws, it is nevertheless helpful to define these terms. And without going much into detail of the discussions regarding, for example, content types and motivation that I elaborated on in my chapter, I have chosen the following definition, and that is: fake news is verifiably false or misleading information that is created, presented, and disseminated to intentionally deceive the public. So it does not include bad journalism, satire, or parody, for example, and it also excludes already illegal types of speech such as defamation, hate speech, Holocaust denial, and incitement to violence. There are usually three rationales that are given for protecting freedom of expression as a fundamental right. Firstly, freedom of expression is the lifeblood of democracy. It's absolutely vital for informed political discussions. Secondly, it empowers personal development and for us to find out how we wish to live our own lives. And thirdly, it allows scientific and factual claims to be critically tested. Now, it is not immediately apparent how intentional publication of false information assists these three core objectives, and yet some of the highest courts around the world have shown their strict protective stance and rejected the categorical exclusion of false statements from the protection of freedom of expression. While the highest judicial authority for fundamental rights in Europe, the European Court of Human Rights, has also clarified its strict stance in relation to freedom of expression, it operates more on a case-by-case basis, engaging in a unique balancing exercise of societal and personal interests, and then allowing the more important interests to prevail. So the whole framework is set up a bit differently. And Article 10.1 of the European Convention on Human Rights and confers freedom of expression as the freedom to hold opinions and to receive and impart information and ideas without interference by public authority. And all forms of expression are included, most notably orally and printed, but also various forms of behavior and activities. However, the court itself has not yet directly dealt with the question whether legislating banning fake news is compatible with Article 10.1 of the Convention, even though there is a case pending since 2008 that to date has not been adjudicated. And in a recent judgment against Poland, the court, very interestingly so, for the first time and on its own volition, used the term fake news. And neither the applicant and nor the Polish government had actually made use of the term in their submissions, owing to the fact that it was not a fake news case per se. It concerned rather defamation and an applicant's right to freedom of expression as a politician at election time. And also the case dates back to 2007, so well before the era of fake news. So this choice is very interesting because it suggests that the court used this case as an opportunity to signal its acknowledgement of the existence and scale of the problem of online disinformation and hopefully its preparedness to address it. When we apply the current legal framework, which was developed by the court, we can see that it has two weapons in its arsenal that it uses to tackle problematic speech. One, the assessment of the legitimacy of interference with freedom of expression under Article 10.2, and second, more radically, assessment under Article 17's abuse clause, where the court will strike out five cases and label them as being inadmissible if applicants are abusing the human rights which are contained in the convention by relying on them to justify and further their totalitarian or extremist causes. So where the right to freedom of expression is relied upon by applicants to justify content that simply infringes essential values of democracy, the court will strike them out. And without going much into detail, I will only very briefly share the conclusions of the detailed case law analysis that can be found in my chapter. I found that within this set framework, restriction of free expression in the name of fake news does appear to be possible, although the scope of such laws will be severely limited. It appears that only restrictions of undisputable false statements, which are backed with convincing evidence as to impact, distributed with a proven intent to deceive the public and are subject to individual and independent judicial review and reasonable penalties, are likely to be deemed compatible with the right to freedom of expression. Moreover, all of these conditions mean that those few legal measures that are possible are rather questionable from a perspective of effectiveness then. So with these findings, it becomes clear that operating under a traditional approach to the current European freedom of expression framework thus offers somehow unsatisfactory conclusions for a problem that has arisen in an entirely new context of a very different communication and media landscape than when the court developed its case law in the 50s and 70s. And thus the core of my chapter then goes on to examine whether the court's existing legal framework can somehow be reconceptualized in a way to allow for wider possibility for restrictions of fake news. And there are two novel legal approaches that I discuss in detail. One, the option of treating fake news not as actually news, but merely as false advertising in political speech as clothing, and thus using the court's case law on commercial speech, which gives states a much wider margin of appreciation when enacting laws. And second, the internet and social media platforms have reformed the ways how content is disseminated, and traditional media is increasingly being replaced by individuals producing and distributing content outside any professional standards. And the court has so far failed to directly comment on whether this special role that it has given to the traditional media, and which requires journalists to act in good faith and on an accurate factual basis, also extends to other actors in this new media environment that we are currently experiencing. And relying on the court's case law, an argument can be made that all internet users that comment on news are on equal footing with professional journalists in terms of ability, reach, and influence. And as such, they should also be subject to certain duties and responsibilities, which may be imposed on them by the law. And with these analyses, the chapter concludes that the law can indeed address fake news while preserving the right to freedom of expression. And the extent of which it can do so will, of course, ultimately depend on the concrete type of regulatory method that governments put in place. And there are various options, but to keep it short generally, and keeping considerations of effectiveness and potential democratic costs in mind, indirectly addressing fake news through regulating other technological, economic, or social processes appears the safest option. And given the nature and the cross-border dimension of the problem of fake news, there appears to be the need for a solution at centralized level to ensure efficacy and justice. And while it's going beyond my chapter contribution to this Anthem Press series volume, I wanted to use the remaining minutes to give you a very brief outlook on some of the developments here in Brussels, as there are many interesting policy and regulatory developments in the area of online disinformation taking place at European Union level at the moment. So already back in 2015, the EU launched the EEAS East Stratcom Task Force, which holds a mandate to counter Russian disinformation campaigns, also with a view especially of Eastern Partnership countries. And then several European Commission communications on disinformation followed. And in 2018, the Commission adopted its Code of Practice against disinformation and, on a broader scale, its Action Plan against disinformation. And this Action Plan set up a rapid alert system on disinformation, consisting of EU institutions and member states that functions to provide alerts on disinformation campaigns, to share insights, and to facilitate coordinated responses, also with international partners like the G7 response mechanism and NATO. And this plan also set out to raise awareness and to improve societal resilience against fake news by supporting independent media fact checkers or financing targeted campaigns by small and medium-sized enterprises, etc. And also very importantly, this act urged for the mobilization of the private sector to tackle disinformation, which was done via the implementation of the EU-wide Code of Practice on Disinformation, to which big companies such as Google or Facebook or Twitter have signed up to. And for the moment, this is an entirely voluntary framework, so a soft law instrument that suggests platforms to adopt certain self-regulatory measures. And these best practices are phrased rather broad and generally commit the signatories to implement measures that help people make informed decisions when they encounter online news that may be false, to prioritize authentic and authoritative information in its search and news feeds, and to make it easier to find diverse perspectives on a topic. And other obligations, for example, also include that ads should be clearly labeled if they are mistakable with news, that clear policies against misuse of automated bots should be adopted, the need for transparency as to algorithmic targeting of users, etc. And all these signatories to this code, they must draw up an annual report. And during the COVID-19 times, they were also asked to draw up specific reports on how they did and what they did to tackle the COVID-19 specific fake news. Nevertheless, the assessment of the code showed some weak points. So the Commission has published a new guidance in May this year and addresses these shortcomings by outlining a plan to strengthen the Code of Practice. And the renewed code will introduce tailored commitments based on the type of platform, notably also aiming to extend the code to messaging services such as WhatsApp and Signal, because we're seeing more and more that fake news are actually shared in smaller messaging groups now. And it will also work to demonetize disinformation and introduce a monitoring framework with a set of key performance indicators. And the signatories, they will have then to publish the measures they adopt to counter disinformation in a so-called transparency center. And current signatories to the code have kicked off the process of drafting this new code before the summer, and the final draft is expected to be ready sometime at the end of this year, 2021. And in addition to these soft law approaches, the Commission has further proposed a legislative instrument called the Digital Services Act, which is currently still being discussed in the European Parliament and Council and expected to take at least 18 months before adoption and implementation. And this proposal establishes a co-regulatory backstop for the measures that will be included in the revised and strengthened code. So the Digital Services Act aims to modernize and create an EU-wide uniform framework on the handling of illegal content online. So amongst others, it introduces obligations to put in place user-friendly notice and takedown mechanisms for illegal information, and it imposes very steep fines for non-compliance. However, of course, we see that it does not directly cover fake news, since disinformation is not illegal under EU and most national member states law, of course, with the exception of very specific fake news that also concern hate speech or Holocaust denial or incitement to violence. And some members of the European Parliament have argued for amendments to also include harmful content in the scope of this instrument, but currently there appears to be a broad consensus that harmful but legal content requires a different set of provisions and that this instrument remain within illegal content scope. However, even though fake news may not be directly in the scope, this instrument does introduce some mandatory general obligations for very large online platforms. So those platforms which have more than 45 million active monthly users in the EU, and these would be a game changer for the fight against fake news. And such obligations concern, for example, transparency as to advertisement and algorithms that are used to display content, as well as a duty to cooperate with researchers in this regard, and importantly, to undertake annual risk assessments and then to take appropriate risk mitigating action. So here, depending on the findings of these reports, taking action to counter fake news, if found to be a big risk, could be legally required. So we see that a lot is happening, but many important questions on how these measures will look like in the end, and as to their effectiveness and practice, remain open for now. And we will also have to wait and see if and how the court adapts to the new media landscape that we now live in. So for this moment, I would say only time will tell, I suppose.
WHCR 90.3 FM, New York.